Hey guys, I'm Adam Rappaport, and this is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. All right, up first this week, we have on associate editor Hillary Cadigan, who is chatting with her longtime chef crush, Nina Compton. Nina is the James Beard Award-winning chef owner of Bywater American Bistro and Compère Lapin in New Orleans. Nina talks about what it was like to grow up in St. Lucia, cooking with her grandmother, the experience of being a competitor on Top Chef with the legendary Leah Chase as a judge, and plenty more. And after that, I chat and drink with associate editor Alex Delaney, who showed up on set with a tray of cocktails that he is going to be making till the end of summer. The Little Ripper, the Siesta, and the Spaghetti. You'll have to listen to find out what is in each. Oh, one announcement before we get started. BA just launched a very cool new thing, a merch shop. That is right. We are now making very cool t-shirts and hats with a lot more things coming in the near future. You can check it out at shop.bonappetit.com. Give it a look. We appreciate it. All right. Here's the show.
Okay. Today we're here with Nina Compton of New Orleans, a chef that I have loved from afar for a really long time. This is kind of the first time we're meeting in person, I think. Well, we met very briefly at another time, and we've spoken on the phone. But full disclosure, I wrote a little story in print and digitally that began with the sentence, "My crush on Nina Compton started from afar, but totally wasn't creepy, I swear." So it's really cool of her to be here after I wrote such a creepy thing about her and how I was obsessed with her.
I'm facing my crush.
Exactly. So this is very awkward. There's a lot of tension in this room right now. No, I'm just kidding. But so we're here to just kind of chat. Yeah. And you're from St. Lucia.
Yeah.
How old were you when you left?
I was 16,
Okay.
16 when I left.
Yeah. What's your first food memory? What was it like growing up there?
My first food memory, I would say, is growing up in the Caribbean and spending weekends on the beach with my family. That was a very big thing. Like every weekend, we go to the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd always bring like fruit, oranges, mangoes, this and that. So my first like real food memory is like going into the ocean and like dipping a beautiful ripe mango in the salt water and having a bite.
Mm-hmm.
That is like my, when I think about my childhood, it's that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's nothing else but just family time on the beach. I mean, we would be at the beach from like 10 a.m. till sundown. And my mom like, "We gotta go." And I'm like, "No, mom, I wanna stay. But that was just like, and we would never get tired of going to the beach.
Mm-hmm. And you lived right near the beach? So it's like
pretty much you can see the beach. We live on a hill that oversees Pigeon Island, but you can see the ocean. So that's something that's very, very dear to me. I love being close to the water.
Wow. Yeah. And what did your family do? Like, who was there a chef in the family that taught you?
Not so much a chef. It was more of my grandmother and my mom.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother was a retired nurse, and as she got older, my mom said like, "Just come live with us, and you know, just be close to the family." So every morning she would be up, first one up, making like, you know, tea, and she'd be sitting out eating breakfast, and then she'd like plan a whole day, like, "Okay, we're gonna have chicken today," and she'll get the chicken ready, and she'd like cut the onions and start making a stock. So it's like that was her life, was just like cooking and like organizing the meals for the day.
Mm-hmm.
As I got older, I'm like, "Oh, my granny, you wanna help? I'll cut the onions for you, I'll pick the parsley, I'll do stuff like that." So that was a really important part for me because we became very close.
Mm-hmm.
You know, over the years it was just like not just picking parsley, but it was like, "Okay, now we're gonna do Christmas lunch together, and like, what can I do?" And then it just became more and more of that was our bond, was being in the kitchen together.
Mm-hmm. And you said your grandma was from England,
is that right? Yeah.
So how did she get to St. Lucia?
Oh, my grandmother, she's brave because she met my grandfather. She was a nurse and my grandfather was a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And they both were there during the war. And she would tell me some crazy stories about rationing food because there was just no food. It was like you'd get like a can of corned beef and that was like luxury.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear these crazy stories of just like the appreciation of having a good meal or a hot meal. And my grandfather had finished school. And he said, I'm going back to St. Lucia. And my grandmother fell in love with him. And she said, "I'm going to come with you." And he's like, "Well, okay." And there were no planes. They were like, not like how we travel now. We can just jump on a plane and 8 hours you're in a different country. So she had to take a boat that brought bananas from the Caribbean to England. And they would do it like every 2 weeks. And it's 10 days you're at sea. And they had these small little cabins where it's like 3 or 4 cabins where you pay a fare. But you basically stay on this banana boat for 10 days.
Wow.
And she did that, not ever being to Central. You can't research, you can't Google. You know, this is the 40s. And
she was just like, I love this guy. I'm going to ride this banana boat for 10 days.
And she did it. And she got there and she was just like, oh my God. Because it was back then, it was just very rustic. You know, people didn't have cars. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one or two people might have cars on the island. So to get around, you had to take a water taxi. And it was just not developed. And she was just like, what is this food? I don't know what this is. I don't know what flying fish is. I don't know, you know, how to cook, you know, green bananas. Like, she was just culture shocked.
Yeah.
And also the way that people cooked, there were not any electric stoves. A gas stove was like a luxury. And they cooked on a coal pot. And my grandmother would tell me, she's like, you know, every day I'd wake up and she's like, I'm English. Mm-hmm. We love to have our cup of tea in the morning. Yeah. And she's like, I would have to light a fire, put a pot on, make it boil. And that's how I'd make my tea. It's like 45 minutes, you know, like to make everything from start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And I just can't fathom like having to go through that, you know, and just have no heads up. It's just like, she just did it.
Yeah.
You know, and she also embraced the food and the cuisine and the culture of everything, because it's, you know, when you don't know anything about that, you just have to find out the hard way, kind of,
mm-hmm.
which she did.
Was there someone there teaching her how to cook, or did she just, I mean, because you said your grandfather was originally from St. Lucia,
yeah.
and came to England and then they went back
together. And
then
together. He went back, yeah. Mm-hmm. So once they got married and had a family, they had a housekeeper, and she was the one that kind of showed my grandmother how to like cook like a local.
Mm-hmm.
So they would go to the market and get like the fish and the chicken and everything else, and they would just say, this is how we do it here. So she kind of caught on pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And did she have particular dishes that like became her specialties?
She loved cooking flying fish. Flying fish it's a small fish that's actually quite flat.
Mm-hmm.
And you typically just fillet it and then you flour it and then you fry it. And she used to do that with like a lemon parsley sauce, and that was her thing. She's mm-hmm. like, oh, she's like, I want to treat you today. We're going to have flying fish for lunch. I'm like, okay, granny, you do that.
Did you like that as a kid?
Oh my God, I love it.
Yeah.
I miss it. It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you were 16, you know, what made your family move?
Because we had that England connection, my mm-hmm. mom wanted us to experience, you know, going to school in England.
Mm.
So we did our final 2 years of high school in England. So that was a little bit of a culture shock for me, because I was 16 and it sounded very exciting. I'm like, oh, I get to live in a different country and I get to see all these things. And my mom was there the first, you know, couple of weeks that I was there. And I'm like, this is great, Mom. You know, I'm making all these friends. And then she's like, I got to go back to St. Lucia. And I'm like, no, don't leave me. And I'm like, and then I got really sad and depressed, because you're 16 years old and it seems like fun, but then it's like you had to figure out things pretty quickly by yourself, because you can't be like, oh, Mom, can you pick me up? Can you do this? You had to really grow up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So for me, I became very independent very quickly.
And you were just there on your own?
I was there by myself.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like,
so you had to really fend for yourself and also surround yourself with other people. I had a very strong connection with a lot of international students, because we were going through the same things.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have family here. We didn't have any friends. So I had friends from Egypt, friends from South Africa, friends from Russia. So we were all like going through this together, and we would share different stories about food and, you know, what was Christmas like, you know, in their countries and things like that, because we were just like, we're homesick,
mm-hmm.
you know, so we all had each other's back in that sense.
Yeah. And like, you know, no offense to the British, but I assume there was a bit of a rude awakening there from like Caribbean food
right,
to like,
right.
oh, British food.
Well, actually wasn't bad, because I love fish and chips.
Okay, so there you go.
I think I gained like I must have been like 20 pounds. I mean, I was chubby.
Yeah.
Because I was just like, I don't get this at home. I want as many cream pies as possible.
Yeah.
And yeah,
no vegetables here. We just
fish and chips, yeah. Yorkshire pudding. You know, it was good.
You were down with the British food?
Yeah, I was just like, because the thing is, you know, when you come from, you know, where it's from, the States or the Caribbean, you take some things for granted until those things are taken away from you or you don't have them as frequently. So whenever I'd come home, I would appreciate, you know, going into the garden and getting fresh fruit, you know, or getting like coconut water. Like that's, every time I go home, there's a coconut man that has a pickup truck and it's just a mound of coconuts.
Yep.
And you just go and you say, how many coconuts do you want? 10. And you just pours it in and you eat the jelly. And for me, I can't get enough of that.
Mm-hmm.
But growing up, you just took it for granted.
Yeah,
you
know? Totally.
Like I tell my mom, I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, she's like, oh, you know, the mango tree, it's mango season. There's so many mangoes on the ground because we just can't keep up. And I'm like, I would kill for that right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anybody would.
Yeah, totally. And it's I lived in Thailand for 3 years and the same thing where like, you know, you'd walk down the street and there was the baby coconut seller. Like he only sold the little babies, which were like the perfect, you know, the meat was so tender and the drink. Like,
yeah.
And then you come here and it's like,
it's not the same. A fresh coconut, it cannot beat anything that you get in a can or a bottle. It's not the same.
No, I've been searching for it ever since. Yeah. Closest I've come is that like pressed coconut.
Oh, yeah,
kind of, at least it's got the chunks in it.
It's not the same.
It's not the same. Yeah. And you get that like full body craving where you're just like, I need that right now and I don't know what else to do.
Agreed.
Yeah. So how long were you in England?
2 years.
Okay.
After 2 years, I came back home and I think just living in a bigger country, you know, I didn't know what I was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom was like, well, you should think about university and all these things. And at that time, agriculture was a very big industry back home. Tourism hadn't really taken off then. So that just seemed like a natural thing that, you know, if I studied, like I'd have a job to come back to. And I looked at universities and then I'm like, do I really want to do this? And I remember I came home on holiday break and I was helping my grandmother in the kitchen. I'm like, okay, let's plan Christmas meal, and we did everything. And I just took the reins, and I'm like, I'm gonna take care of everything. I'm gonna do all these things. And I remember just seeing the reaction from how happy my family was. We were just having a good time, it was just company, and we sat outside of our veranda and just like, just hung out and just ate and just drank wine and just we're just having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I told my mom, I'm like, I wanna cook. And she's like, you sure you want to do that? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, why not? It's fun, you know. You can learn so many different things, and I can travel the world. And she's like, listen, you are gonna be stressed out. No holidays off. No weekends. Da da da. Schedule's gonna change. She's like, it's hot. It's stressful. You're gonna burn yourself. You're gonna cut yourself. And I'm like, mom, I'm like, I have to at least try. And she's like, okay, fine. She's like, I'll make some phone calls. So she calls the owners of Sandals Resorts. And she said, my daughter wants to be in the kitchen. And he's like, oh, are you sure she wants to do that? And he's like, that's exactly what I told Nina. Like, is she sure? And I remember it was, again, Christmas time. There I am peeling carrots and onions and I'm chopping away, like very sad, just thinking, you know, my whole family is like opening gifts and having a good old time. And
no holidays for me anymore.
And I remember I came home and I was so sad. And my mom is like, you see, I told you. And then it's like, once I got through that first Christmas, I was fine. I did that for a year. And then I felt like I wasn't moving up. And I told the general manager of the hotel, I said, listen, I want to go to a different property. And he said, well, where do you want to go? And I said, I think I want to live in Jamaica for like, you know, a year, 6 months, whatever you think is fitting.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a year and I loved it so much. And I'm just like, can I extend it for one more year? And I had just a blast living in Jamaica because the people were so much fun. It was a different island. I was learning different things. And I did the same thing where I did all the stations, all the restaurants, and I kind of felt like I hit a ceiling. And I told my chef, and I'm like, I feel like I can't move up. I'm like, I've done everything, but I feel like I'm just stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And he had gone to the CIA in New York and he said, well, go to culinary school, either Johnson Wales or CIA. And I came back and I told my parents, I'm like, I think the next step is culinary school. And I did that. And that again was eye-opening because it was in Hyde Park, in the middle of nowhere, and winters were brutal. And I was just like, this is, I'll just get through this. Yeah. And then, you know, it's because my whole thing was too that I didn't have a green card or anything else. So I was on a student visa. So I only had a limited amount of time here. So I said, you know, if I'm going to be here, I want to learn from the best because I don't have that much time, you know. So I couldn't really pick and choose and say, well, I'm going to do, you know, 2 months here or this month. I want things to matter and make sense. So at that time, you know, French food was the everything. And, you know, I said, if I'm going to learn from somebody, I wanted to work for Daniel Boulud. Mm. And that was a really eye-opening experience because it was such an intense kitchen.
Yeah. What was and that like?
It was intense. I mean,
stories.
I, you know, looking back on it, it's, you have to have a really thick skin. And I think that it was just, there was no making a mistake there. I was young, you know, yeah. So it was like my first real, like, intense New York experience. And it was at this restaurant that was, you know, the highest of the high. Mm-hmm. And you go in and you feel you're stressed out all the time. But I did learn a lot. And, you know, Alex Lee was the chef de cuisine at the time. And I learned a lot just by watching him because he wasn't very chatty in the kitchen, but he was just very focused. Mm-hmm. And he was just like, we're going to do everything right. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody was on the same page. So I think for me, working in that environment kind of set a tone for me.
Yeah.
So that was kind of my goal of just like, learning from the best. And like, just because I didn't plan being in this country, I've been here for almost 20 years. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't really my plan. My plan was just to do a couple of years and go back home and open a restaurant on the beach.
Yeah.
But that's kind of flip-flop because that's my retirement plan.
No, that's still the plan. Yeah, pushing it back.
Yeah. Still the plan.
So did, like, working in a resort kitchen, I imagine, is like a totally different experience than working
it's
kind of like you're part of an army in that case.
Being in a resort, it's more like, it's like different classrooms, mm-hmm. you know. But, you know, when you're in an independent restaurant that is focused on certain, everybody knows what's going on. Whereas being in a resort, it's more spread out. Mm-hmm. But it was actually a good experience to have that hotel experience at a young age and then go into an independent restaurant. You know, I think it keeps you a little more versatile than just being one way.
Mm-hmm. And then what made you decide to stay? You were like, and how were you able to stay?
Well, I got sponsored through my sister. Mm-hmm. But I saw it as, you know, I loved, you know, being in New York for that time, but it was too cold.
Yeah.
I couldn't deal with it. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to work with Norman Van Aken because, you know, this is early 2000s and he was doing something that I could relate to. He was cooking with a lot of Caribbean ingredients, you know, a lot of tropical ingredients at a very high level. And I'm like, he's doing stuff that I would never think of, mm-hmm. you know, just using yuca and using conch and all these things that nobody was using. And I'm like, I want to work with him. Mm-hmm. And it was very hard to get into that kitchen because he had a line out the door of people just applying. And finally I got the call to say, you know, we do have a spot. If you're interested, you know, come on down. And I was there with, you know, almost 2 years. And it was just one of those things where I just wanted to just get my hands in all the different cuisines and just really excel and try and learn as much as I can. So hopefully that one day I can apply all those different techniques, you know, in my kitchen.
Mm-hmm. And so did you feel like you learned new, like you were kind of seeing Caribbean cooking from a different angle?
Yeah,
there?
It was, you know, he really refined humble ingredients that I grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just things that we just don't really do at home. But he took the foundation of the ingredients or the flavor profiles and said, okay, this is how we take it to the next level. And it was just really eye-opening to see that. And it was very refreshing because I think that kitchen was very instrumental in what I am doing now because mm-hmm. I always kept in the back of my mind, you know, his techniques and the way he used ingredients that I grew up with.
Yeah. Was there a particular one that you remember that you were like, oh, this can be used like this?
Well, yeah. I mean, he did this conch chowder that is just I still dream about that dish. It's simple, you know, but he used habaneros and orange juice, and he put a little saffron in there, which we don't really use, but it really has this kind of special flavor profile. When you try it collectively, it's delicious. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then what happened next? How did you end up in New Orleans? Were you back in the Caribbean for a while?
No,
first,
I got stuck in Miami for 14 years.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was just the lifestyle of being on the beach and tropical and not so stressful.
Mm-hmm. How does Miami compare, like cooking in Miami compared to cooking in the Caribbean?
It's similar.
Yeah.
It's similar, but it's also different at the same time. But it's also, it's very relatable because you have every Caribbean island possible, mm-hmm. you know, or Latin American country too. So you have this big melting pot of Haitian, Jamaican, Trinidad, Guyanese, Dominican, Puerto Rican, Cuban, El Salvador, Mexico, like everything is all mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
So you see a lot of similar things, but you see a lot of different things as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that was great for me. And I think that's what was nice, because you could just pick and choose if you're going to have, you know, Colombian lunch today and just experience that. So that was fun. But, you know, I just felt like, I'm like, is Miami the last stop for me?
Right.
And I'm like, I'm too young to just like say this is it. And, you know, when I did Top Chef, that was my first time going to New Orleans, and I had never experienced that. But I remember driving through the French Quarter in the Garden District. I'm like, oh my God, I'm like, look at all these beautiful houses, and you see like musicians playing in the French Quarter. So for me, it was very captivating.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the culture for me was really similar to the Caribbean, but it was also very different. And New Orleans has a special feel where you don't feel like you're in the States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does.
And it's just a fun environment and people about life. And I said, I'm like, if I'm going to make somewhere my last stop, this would be it.
Mm-hmm. So how did the Top Chef thing happen? Because whenever I watch that show, I'm just like, I cannot imagine a more hellacious thing than being on the show. I don't know why anyone would ever choose to do this. Like, what made you be like, yep, I'm going to do this. Let's go.
The funny thing is that they called me up, and I think I froze. I froze for a second. I'm like, I need to think about this. I'm like, I have a full-time job. I just can't pick up and leave for, you know, for 6 to 8 weeks. You know, it's what if I don't have a job when I come back?
Mm-hmm.
So I told him I'll think about it. And I called my mom, and I'm like, Mom, I'm like, I got a chance to do this show. And I'm like, you know, it's $100,000 to win. And she's like, well, what if you lose? And I'm like, yeah, that's true. That's possible.
Yeah.
That's a big possibility. And then she's like, but it's too stressful. And she's like, I'll never watch the show if you're on it. She told me that. She's like, I'll never watch it. She's like, I can't eat. She's like, even if you tell me, I still can't watch it.
I love this as your mom's just like recurring anthem. Like, it's going to be really stressful. You should probably not do it. And you're like, okay, I'm going to do it.
Right. So I told her, and I'm like, Mom, I'm like, I could win. I said, also, it could be good exposure to let people know about who I am, what island I'm from, because a lot of people don't know where St. Lucia is. People always think it's part of the Virgin Islands, and it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, I could really just give people just a little bit of education here. And I told her, I'm like, yeah, Mom, I think I'm gonna do it. And the process to get, you know, screened and then finally called back, it's a long time. And it was actually a fun experience. I think that...
Really?
Yeah, it was. It's not easy. It's very stressful.
Yeah.
It's probably the hardest thing I've ever done.
Uh-huh.
Because you cannot prepare for that. I mean, when they said, okay, you're going to be in New Orleans for Top Chef, and I did all my research, they were like, my mom is like, she's like, if you're going to go to New Orleans, she's like, you know, you have to learn how to cook nutria. And I'm like, what the hell is nutria? She's like, it's this rodent that they eat there.
Yeah.
And I'm like Googling, where can I buy nutria?
I love it. That's what she told you. You need to cook.
She's like, yeah, they cook nutria and they do this and they do that. And I'm thinking about, okay, what if I have to make beignets? What if that's a challenge? And what if, so I'm thinking about all these possibilities and everything that you think that is common sense they would actually do in the show, they didn't do.
Mm.
I mean, we had to cook gumbo, and I'm like, And Leah Chase was the judge.
Oh, God.
And I thought I was doing the coolest thing. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to be making this. And she's like, honey, this is not gumbo. She's like,
what did you do?
I can't remember. But I don't think I put even rice. But
you're like, there's some nutria in it.
Yeah. I don't even know what I put it. I don't think I put rice. I was trying to like go anti gumbo just to make a mark. Mm-hmm. And she was just like very traditional. She's like, this is not gumbo.
Yeah. Were you just like shattered? I mean, what's it like when Leah Chase tells you didn't make gumbo right?
I was just petrified because she is such a, you know, sweet woman, but she tells you how it is. Mm-hmm. We became pretty close after that. And I remember she came in to Compila Pen for dinner. And she called, she's like, I'm going to come in for dinner tonight. Are you going to be there? And I said, yes, I'm going to be there. And I remember I was so stressed out because I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm cooking for Leah Chase. I'm like, she's probably making notes. And she's probably going to sit me down at the end of the meal and say, this was wrong. This was overseas. And this was, you know, because you just never know.
Yeah.
And she was so complimentary.
Really?
And she just said, I'll never forget that she says, I'm rooting for you. She's like, you have to make it. She's like, you have to succeed. And I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, you have to make it. You have to succeed. You have to like blow people away. And she's like, it's not easy. And she's like, you're a woman of color. She's like, you have to push through, you have to make it. And I'm like, okay, back to the kitchen I go.
Yeah. Was that the first time you had cooked for her since the gumbo, non-gumbo incident?
And she's just, I just loved her energy and just the way she just knew so much. She just knew everything about New Orleans and she could tell. She reminded me so much of my grandmother, to be honest. Because she went through the same hardships, but she made it. And, you know, we went to her funeral and most of her staff have been with her for 35 plus years.
Wow.
And every story is so unique and so different. And I remember there was one lady, she still works there, she's a waitress. And she says, I remember the first day that I worked with Miss Lear, I came to the kitchen. And she's like, I didn't know where anything was. And I was asking a bunch of questions. And she's like, Leah's like, I'm going to show you where everything is. And you're going to stop asking me questions. You need to figure it out. And she's like, okay. And she's like, I remember Leah just running circles around everybody. And she's like 60 at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And she tells her husband at the time, she's like, can you put this flower up on the shelf? And I guess he forgot about it or something. And she just picked it up and just threw it on the shelf. And she was just like, she's like, I don't have time for this. I'm just going to do it myself. But she was just that kind of person that she was just very strong-willed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever get to witness her in the kitchen, like in action?
You know, it's when I moved to New Orleans, she wasn't that mobile, but, you know, people say she's always in the kitchen. I'm like, there's no way she's always in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was one day I came by and I brought her some flowers. And I'm like, is Miss Leah back there? And they're like, yeah, she's in the kitchen. And there she is. In her wheelchair, in the kitchen. I'm like, you gotta retire. And she's like, no. She's like, I gotta be in the kitchen. And every time I go, she is there. Yeah. And I think that's what kept her alive for so long, because that's something that she loved. And she just, that was just her life.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, you're 90 something years old, Leah. Just, they have it, they got it. And she's like, no, I wanna be in the kitchen. And she did what she loved till the end, which is pretty special.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. Yeah. And she changed the entire landscape of cooking in New Orleans. And then, you know, it's just, I mean, what was, I guess I'm also curious what it was like coming there. You know, you'd done this Top Chef thing, you had your gumbo incident.
Right.
And then you're like, all right, I'm moving to New Orleans. Yeah. Like, I'm going to bring this, like a culture that you had already that was so strong into a city that already has like such a strong and kind of insular culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, what was that like to come onto that landscape and be like, oh, I'm opening a restaurant?
Well, it's funny because when we knew that we were going to open a restaurant, I'm like, I think we'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then an article came out before we opened, says Nina Compton opens a restaurant, is opening a restaurant in the Warehouse District. And it was this big, big article in the local paper. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm like, they're making this a big thing. I'm telling my husband, I'm like, what are we going to do? I'm like, I was trying to come under the radar, like, you know, just open a restaurant very quietly. And when we got there, we didn't know anybody. Mm-hmm. We didn't know, not a single soul. And we would go to different restaurants and the chefs would come to the kitchen and they'd be like, they're like, oh, chef, you know, welcome to the city. We're so happy to have you. You know, if you need help with anything, like finding purveyors, like, let me know. You know, we'll talk to anybody, like, just to help you out. And I'm just like, this is kind of strange that everybody's so nice and so helpful.
Yeah, like, are they about to punk me?
Yeah, right. But that's just how they are.
Wow.
And people were thanking us for opening a restaurant in New Orleans. They're like, thank you for coming to the city and, you know, doing something different. And people sent us flowers and cards opening night. And it was just really nice.
Wow.
And I think that says a lot about a city where they're confident and they're also very secure that, you know, even if 10 new restaurants open up, mm-hmm. that if you are able to back it up, then you have nothing to worry about,
mm-hmm.
you know, because everybody shares the wealth and everybody is very supportive. And that's the biggest thing when we opened a restaurant was to support the locals. You know, it is a very transient city,
mm-hmm.
but the focus was identifying locals and making sure that when they come to the restaurant, we recognize them and make them feel like, you know, thank you for coming back. Because there's hundreds of restaurants that you can go to every single night.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to come back here 3 times a week, but they do. And I love that.
Yeah.
So I think that's something you really have to appreciate. And a lot of people, I would say they don't do that. And I think that's when you make people feel like, oh, welcome back. Do you want your usual glass of, you know, Sauvignon Blanc? That goes a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something we really practice every day.
Yeah. And does it seem like most of the restaurants that open there are more catering towards the tourists and the people that are coming briefly? Or is it?
I think it's a little bit of both.
Yeah.
You know, you definitely feel a jump when there's a convention in town.
Mm-hmm.
But the locals definitely, people eat out a lot in New Orleans and they'll have breakfast and they're like, what are we having for lunch? Where are we going for lunch? And then they'll be at lunch like, where are we going for dinner tonight? It's like, and they're very friendly and they're very open. Like if you're at a bar just having a casual drink and somebody, you overhear somebody talking, like you're not intruding, but you just chime in and it becomes like this very contagious, you know, sharing of knowledge. Like, oh, well, have you been to this restaurant? You should check it out. You know, they're open, you know, 5 days a week or they're closed this day, but check it out. You should go on Tuesdays because they're doing a fish fry, you
mm-hmm.
know. So those things, I think that it's just about, it's not keeping everything to yourself, but it's like sharing because mm-hmm. they're proud of the city and what we do.
Mm-hmm. And why did you choose New Orleans as your location in the first place?
It spoke to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's a very special place where everybody's welcome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody is left out. It's all type of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is no judgment. It's just, you have a good attitude, you take care of people, and they'll take care of you back.
Yeah. And have there been particular chefs there that have, you know, been mentors for you or that?
A lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, Donald Link is a very dear friend. Emeril's a dear friend. You know, Leah Chase, everybody really was very helpful,
mm-hmm.
you know, helping us along the way. And it's still a very tight community now
mm-hmm.
where, you know, chefs say, hey, I'm doing this event. Do you want to help out? And 20 people just sign me up. I'm in. And that's the great thing where there is no judgment or like, what do I get out of it? It's more like, I'm going to help you out because you're my friend and whatever you need.
Mm-hmm. And then, so when you did open Compare Le Pin, like, you know, you're bringing this very specific vision that mm-hmm. you had to this restaurant and to the city, you know, but you did kind of incorporate some local elements too.
Yes.
Like, how did you sort of find the balance between like, okay, I'm in New Orleans, this steeped in history,
mm-hmm.
steeped in culture city that's unlike anywhere else,
right.
but I'm bringing this very specific restaurant idea. You know, how did you sort of put together the menu and the concept in a way that felt like of where you came from, but
right.
also of where you
well,
were?
Well, I think it was just a very natural progression. It was the focus of using local farms and having a connection with those farmers. You know, I think that having somebody come in, like, I have this farmer that I have a crush. She's my woman crush. She'll come in and she'll come in, like, her sons will bring me, you know, bushels of vegetables. And mm-hmm. she's like, she's always so busy. And I'm like, Michelle, let's have a cup of coffee. Like, no, chef, I don't have time. But she comes in and her produce is beautiful. And when you have that physical connection with somebody where they come in and it's like, you know, here's my vegetables, here's my tomatoes, and you can have an interaction with somebody and taste that tomato, and you can taste the love that she puts into it. So for me, that was just a natural progression of developing the menu with those people that I have a friendship with.
So after only a few years of having Compare the Pen, then you just went and opened up another restaurant. Mm-hmm. What was the, like, why were you like, okay, this is, it's time, you know?
I was quite content having just the one.
Yeah.
But, you know, my sous chef at the time, Levi Rains, who basically moved to New Orleans to help me open a restaurant, we never worked together. Mm. It was kind of blind faith where I knew his chef at the time and I'm like, listen, I'm opening a restaurant. And he's like, oh, well, you know, I have somebody that is actually, you know, looking for a job. And I'm like, well, I don't have a sous chef position, but I have a cook's position. And, you know, we talked on the phone and Levi's like, I'll be there on Monday. And I'm like, you're coming on Monday? He's like, yeah, I'll drive up on Monday. And I'm like, okay. He came in, we chatted for a while. And he said to me, he's like, you take care of me and I'll take care of you. And that was our handshake agreement.
Yeah.
And once we got into the kitchen, you know, he was just so far advanced than anybody I've worked with. And, you know, as time went on, I said, I'm like, would you want to be the chef de cuisine? He's like, I want to have my own place. And I said, okay. And I'm like, you know, he's young, he's 20, 24. Mm. So I'm like, I went home to my husband. I'm like, oh my gosh. I'm like, we're going to lose Levi. What are we going to do? And he's like, we'll be fine. And I'm like, no, Larry, I'm like, we need to find him. We need to find him a space. And we looked, I would say, for a good 2 solid years.
Oh, wow.
And we had this whole vision of a Creole cottage, you know, just like a nice, cozy little house. Mm-hmm. And we looked and we were so obsessed with that. And then we just couldn't find the right place. And I'm like, okay, we need to just broaden our horizon just a little bit and just see what else we want to do. And we looked at like art studios that we could convert to a restaurant. And then we looked at other places. And then what area do you want to be in? And we looked at an old cooking school. And we looked at so many things. And we were just getting exhausted. I told my husband, I'm like, I'm about to throw in a towel. I'm like, we're just not finding a space.
Yeah.
And I don't want to dangle the carrot any longer.
Like, right.
So that there was a restaurant space in our apartment building on the ground floor. And my husband like, what about this space? And I'm like, no, I'm like, those owners seem really happy. They're busy. They seem to be doing well. Like, I don't want to like rock the boat with them. And he's like, I'm just going to ask them anyway. So he goes to the owners and he says, hey, what do we do? Like, if somebody wanted to buy you out, would you be content of just walking away?
And there was already a restaurant.
There was a restaurant. Yeah. They were functioning. They were busy. Yeah. They had been there for almost 5 years. Uh-huh. And they're like, well, it depends on, you know, who wants to buy us out. And like, well, what if it's us? And they're like, okay. And they're like, let's sleep on it. And then it came back the very next day and they said, okay, this is our number and let's negotiate things.
Wow.
And it took quite some time, like getting everything finalized and getting the keys handed over. But it was just, it was actually, it was very special because it was the three of us combining our vision together. And I remember when we were getting close to opening, we sat on the couch and we looked at the kitchen, the lights were on, and we just had a moment all together. And we just like, look at this little space that we built. Mm-hmm. Like we painted this, we picked the paint, we did all these things. And when you see those things come together, it was just a beautiful moment for us.
Yeah. And you did it in the Bywater, which is kind of tell me about that neighborhood a little bit, because it's kind of its own unique little place within New Orleans.
Well, we live there. Yeah. That's where we live from day one.
Right.
The Bywater, it's a special little place because it's so like unique, mm-hmm. you know, everywhere in New Orleans, every neighborhood is so different. Like you go to the Garden District. And you go to Uptown, that's a different vibe. And then you go to the Bywater, it's like all the buildings are different. Everything is just very different. And we just love the feel of it. Like it's not too frou-frou, but it's like people have a fun time and there's tons of things to do. And like Frenchman Street is right down the street, so they can go have like live music. And it's just fun.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, that you have both spots, yeah. Are you like splitting your time between the two? Or are you letting
pretty much has a handle on everything.
Yeah.
But I do try and go back and forth and check in. You know, it is hard because they're both busy restaurants. Mm-hmm. I also have staff that are jealous. They're like, chef, you're always going to Babs. And I'm like, I gotta go to Babs. And I'm like, then I, if I go to Compare, they're like, you're always at Compare. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't please you guys. Like, let me just live my life.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Yeah.
It was so nice to finally get a chance to sit down in person. Just was totally, kept it totally chill the whole time.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Delaney, I gotta say, I'm a bit intimidated.
Intimidated? Just by my presence or
yeah, just
anything
by you
in particular?
You're a lot of man. No, you have like not one, but two sheet trays. You've got measuring cups, those like slanted OXO ones with the measurements on the side and spouts. You've got a thing of ice. You have a mixer. You have two bottles of Miller High Life and it's like 4:02 p.m.
That's, I think, the appropriate time.
So these are three drinks to make.
Yes.
Before summer ends.
Before summer ends. We're in the 11th hour right now.
Yeah, right. Seriously? I mean, no
joke.
It's
winding down.
All right. What I do like about this spread you got a lot of ice. It's hot as hell out today.
Yes.
It's going to be 93 tomorrow. I need something cold.
Yeah.
So what are we starting with?
Okay. So you may be familiar with the name Emily Schultz. She works for us here
EMP.
At this magazine. EMP, yes. She and I were recently in Baltimore.
Wait, question.
Yes.
Emily Schultz that's her handle on Instagram, or is that on our Slack or something? Or what does the EMP mean? What's the P?
Oh, I think her middle name is Pearl.
Oh.
P is is for
All
Pearl.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's vital information for everyone that listens to the podcast.
But she's a drinks enthusiast.
She is. So Emily and I were both at Wet City, which is a brewery / bar in Baltimore, Maryland. And we had a couple hours to kill before dinner, and we arrived at this place, and we both got a beer, and we're looking at the menu, and at the bottom of the, you know, like the little happy hour card that they kind of just like place on the bar, and it has the specials, and it's like $2 off a pint of whatever between five and seven. It often gets neglected. No one really looks at that, I feel like. But at the bottom, there was something that just said spaghetti without the I, so spaghetti, $5.
And you're like... Gotta order that,
yeah,
right?
I mean, like, even if I ask the bartender and he's like, well, it's some ridiculous thing, I'm like, I'm still gonna order. It's called spaghetti. So we order two of them, and the bartender plops down a bottle of Miller High Life.
Good start so far.
Okay, yeah. And then he drains a little bit off the top and throws some Aperol and some lemon juice in it and just pushes it across the bar. And I was kind of...
Did he say anything?
He's like, this is what spaghetti is, and then did it. And Emily and I are both sitting there, we're like, okay, yeah, very into this entire situation. So, that's what we're going to do right now.
Okay, let's do the open
I was going to, I
microphone.
Also, yeah, this is like a lot of...
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. All right, so the first step is you open your... Preferably a bottle of High Life, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't need to be High Life, though. As long as it's an American lager that is not a light lager. It has to be like a regular Budweiser.
Can we not use the word lager? Can we just say an actual beer, a regular beer?
A beer,
an
yes.
American beer.
An American beer, sure.
No craft nonsense.
Not an IPA.
And also, the one great reason why you do use a bottle of Miller High Life is that because the bottle of Miller High Life is the best bottle ever made.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, look at that label.
Oh, so you take a sip.
Yeah, so you take a sip also. So you got to clear a little bit of space in there.
Yeah, how much space do we want? Like, is it two sips?
You're one large sip, I would say.
So you went to the below the X label atop the neck, or a little below that.
I measured this out. So there's 2 ounces of lemon juice here. Pour half of that, and I will pour the other half.
Does it matter if you go lemon or Aperol first?
I have been doing lemon first and then Aperol, just because I think Aperol is a little bit heavier and it'll sink down.
Yep.
And more evenly distribute. It's also like this isn't dogmatic here.
No.
It's like know yourself. You know what I mean? If you want something that leans more Aperol-y, go in favor of the Aperol. If you want something that leans more tart, go in favor of the lemon.
I'm gonna say I'm probably more of a lemon guy. I find Aperol can go too sweet sometimes.
That's fair.
Oh my God. And then let's talk about why it's called spaghetti.
Okay, so I don't know. There's probably a very small fraction of our podcast listeners that also at some point in their life watched the Tim and Eric show. Spaghetti is actually a reference from the Tim and Eric show.
Okay, so I didn't know this.
Yeah, but if you look at the color of it.
Yes, and we filled it, we blended them all. It looks like spaghetti sauce. It
kind of does, yeah. Also, another reason to use the High Life bottle, it's clear. Yeah, and it just looks 10 times
more beautiful. That's a good, really good reason. You don't want a brown bottle or a green bottle.
No. You want to see this like rose gold.
Yeah. And obviously, the more Aperol you use, the more spaghetti it's going
to
look.
For those that are worried about how this is going to photograph.
All right, let me try this now.
Yeah.
Oh.
Right?
It's like High Life, but better.
That's exactly what it's like. It's the perfect combination of the spritz that you want late summer, the cold, cold ice beer that maybe with you, a couple ice cubes actually in the beer.
Yeah, I might do it in the bottle. I might drink half of it in the bottle and then pour the second half over ice. That's really nice.
I'd support that.
I like it because also, as much as I love the High Life bottle, Miller High Life can be a little skunky tasting sometimes.
That's
and this
fair.
Sort of gives a nice little acidic bite to it.
Yeah.
Have you ever done it with Campari instead of Aperol?
I have. So I've actually done... I'm the person that has like 40 bottles of Amari and
I've read about it.
And Bon Appetit. Oh, yeah, have you?
Yeah.
So yeah, I've been subbing in tons of different stuff just to see what works. It definitely works with Campari. Mm-hmm. You just have to go a little lighter on the lemon juice because there's more bitterness in Campari than there is in Aperol. But it's also really great with Chinar. You can still go 1-to-1 with the Chinar. It's awesome.
Chinar is one made from artichokes.
Yeah. It's like low. It's like 16% like classic Italian artichoke Amaro. Yeah,
good label.
Great label. Green bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Attractive all around.
Love this drink. Love the color of
it.
Yeah, this is like a cool party drink. If you're having friends over, you serve a bunch. You open up a bunch of these. You're like, hey guys.
Oh yeah. Like open up the cooler. There's 24 bottles of High Life there, and then a bottle of Aperol. A bottle of pre-squeezed lemon.
I would say this. What I would do is have them if you're outside and you've got like a Coleman cooler just stocked with ice and these bottles are as cold as they can get. Or I would throw the bottles in the freezer for like 10 minutes beforehand just so they're nice and ice cold.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's actually pretty wild how we wrote this as a highly recommend on bonappetit.com maybe like 3 weeks ago. And the amount of people that are making this already and tagging us on Instagram is actually pretty wild.
And it's like
people are into it.
It was also like our most trafficked story of the month.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Which is we did not expect that to be the most trafficked story.
So, so spaghetti, just spell spaghetti without an I and do Bon Appetit, Google that. And it's part of our daily highly recommend column, which all the editors write about places they're eating, drinks they're drinking, foods they love, etc. Check it out. Highly recommend Bon Appetit. All right. Yeah. Plug is done. Let's do
plug.
That
is
was
done.
Delicious. Love it. What's drink number two?
All right. Number two is kind of when we talk about like simple cocktails, hardly ever do we talk about new cocktails, right? Like there are always cocktails that have been around since the 40s or the 50s.
On Manhattan.
Exactly. So this cocktail was invented in 2006 by Katie Stipe. She's a New York City bartender. Pretty legendary, and it's called the Siesta.
Was there any debate that she invented it? Did someone else say, I used to do blah, blah, blah,
this? Well, there's always going to be someone who says that, but she is credited as inventing this cocktail.
Okay,
and so the Siesta is a tequila-based cocktail. I'm going to try and.
Is that a Boston shaker there?
That is a Boston shaker, two part with a strainer. This is a tequila-based cocktail. And it's kind of a mix between a Paloma and a Hemingway daiquiri.
Mm,
I like where you're going with this. You're taking me down to the tropics, to the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, exactly. Also, I feel like there's going to be some more.
Yeah, let's use the ice.
We got ice ASMR. Going into a shaker.
Go.
A little too much. All right, so basically you want to fill a shaker with ice, and then you're going to do, I doubled the recipe here. So normally it would be 2 ounces of tequila. We're doing 4.
And you're doing tequila blanco?
Blanco, sober. Yeah.
Yep. What was that?
I'm just trying to get, that was also tequila.
Okay.
There's a lot of tequila in this.
Any type of tequila you're drinking these days?
Yeah, you definitely want to keep it blanco. You don't want to go for a reposado or anything like that.
Reposado, sorry. Añejo, none of that.
Or añejo, yeah. None of the aged stuff. And then you're going to do a little bit of grapefruit juice. So it's 3/4 of an ounce of grapefruit juice. I doubled it.
Okay.
And then a little bit of lime juice. And that's also, that's 1 ounce of lime juice. And then this is where it kind of, so here we're like in pretty much in the margarita Paloma territory. Then you add 1/2 ounce of Campari. So, and the Campari adds this bitterness to it, a little bit of that like orangey aspect, and it's kind of a game changer. So always shaken. Ooh. Also, if there's fresh juice in a cocktail, always shaken. You never stir a cocktail with fresh juice in it. It never gets evenly distributed. It'll never get that frothy, beautiful, super cold tropical character that you want. And shake until it is quite cold. So, I don't know, Emma, if this is going to blow out the...
How did you decide that that was enough?
That this was enough?
Yeah.
I mean, you can fit when it starts to get like so cold that your hands can kind of not really take it anymore.
And that the entire shaker is frosted over.
It should totally be frosted. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now let's see if we can get this. Yep. Okay. And then I think you're going to want ice cubes for this. I love this cocktail because you can drink it straight up or with ice.
Okay.
It's really
and
your
if you're
going
to drink it straight up, it might be in a nice pretty little coupe glass or something.
Yes, correct. We have a couple of rocks glasses here, so yeah. I'll give you some ice. And it's that like nice pink color.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Look at that. So summery.
Yeah. And usually this is done with like a lime wedge as a garnish.
Mm-hmm.
I like to double down on the grapefruit, just like a nice little grapefruit peel.
So it's a peel, not a wedge.
You could do a wedge as well, yeah.
The color is kind of magical.
Isn't it?
Yeah, because it's like a really intense pink.
Yeah, it's the grapefruit and the Campari doing their work.
All right, I'm going to take a sip of this.
Do it.
I have thoughts. It's interesting because the grapefruit and the Campari, I think, together somehow suggest saltiness, like when you get salt on the rim of a margarita, but there's no salt in here.
No salt.
What
mysterious forces are at play?
I'm going to say this. I don't know. I would maybe like a lime wedge. I want a little bit of that lime.
Lime instead of grapefruit?
Yeah, that sort of to zip it up. I mean, it's delicious. I would also, I don't know. I was thinking about whether or not, like a Paloma, would I want to spritz it up with a little club soda?
You absolutely could.
What I like about spritz and club soda, I mean, I spritz everything, but...
You do spritz everything.
I do. In the summertime, it's nice because it extends the drink.
Yeah.
So instead of having a 4-ounce drink, you could have a 6 or 8-ounce drink.
For sure.
And if you're just kind of hanging out outside on a deck or whatever, it's nice to just not pound a drink in 4 minutes and be like, oh.
Totally.
Wow, okay, I guess I'm having another drink.
Totally.
I feel like this has a... it's a bit more grown up than like... Because it doesn't have the sweetness of a margarita.
No. And this is also the thing about the siesta. You can do simple syrup in it, mm-hmm. right? And that's what, honestly, most people do for the sake of time. I did not have time to do the simple syrup. I think it functions almost as well without it, but it's a way more assertive.
Well, two things. I would maybe do I don't like overly sweet drinks. I would maybe do a suggestion of simple syrup.
Yeah.
Also, I think what also can... influence the drink's flavor is depending, especially in the winter, you can get some really sweet, juicy grapefruit.
For sure.
And that very much would affect the flavor. And I would obviously never use cartoned grapefruit juice.
No, always fresh.
But yeah, so I might do it. It depends on the sweetness of the grapefruit juice might inform how much simple syrup I would add or not.
For sure. And that's also the thing about like simple syrup. People, it's funny when you make a cocktail for someone and you hand it across the bar, or you make it for two different people, and someone will be like, this cocktail is way too sweet, and someone will be like, this cocktail isn't sweet enough.
Yeah.
The thing about cocktails is like people are very rigid about recipe, but it's also so much about personal preference.
All right, third drink, because I do have a job. Can't be sitting around drinking with you.
You don't sit in the studio all day, record the pod?
I have like a really annoying meeting to go to at 4:30.
Okay, so the last cocktail I am not going to make. We did not have a...
Wow.
I know.
Okay, you know what I'm going to do instead? I'm going to open this bag of Cheez-Its.
The last cocktail is a bag of Cheez-Its. Yeah. Emma's making a face like that sounded terrible.
Cheez-Its. You want some? Okay, what's the last cocktail?
Okay, so the last cocktail is in no way an official cocktail. It has never been written about.
Huh.
It has never been put on a bar menu. That's because it's what I drink at my desk at maybe 6 p.m. when everyone's leaving the office and I'm still here. I'm calling it the Lil Ripper. Why did I invite this?
Are you being honest about 6 p.m. or is that?
I mean, like 6 is like 6 could be 5. You know what I mean?
Also, I will say this, in all fairness. Well, drinking is part of our jobs. Also, 5 p.m. in December is very different than 5 p.m. in August.
Oh, also 5 p.m. in August, this office is.
Yeah,
we don't have coworkers.
So anyways, all right, so what's the Lil Ripper?
The Lil Ripper is, it's also something that I either start when I'm cooking, I either start or end my entire cooking and or meal with. So it's literally a small glass, maybe 6 ounce glass, filled to the top with ice, about an ounce and a half, 2 ounces of, again, individual serving club soda, has to be super, super bubbly, super carbonated.
Also, I will say this. I have a lot of thoughts about club soda. Always keep your club soda cold.
Always.
That affects the carbonation, the density of the bubbles and everything.
Absolutely agree. And then a little bit of whatever aperitivo I'm feeling at the moment.
Like right now is what?
Like right now it is Forte Red, which is an aperitivo, a bitter orange aperitivo that's made in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn.
Okay.
But the night before it was Leopold Brothers from Denver.
Okay.
Their aperitivo. So a little splash, like you're not going heavy on either the club soda or the aperitivo. Again, maybe like an ounce and a half. And then a squeeze of lemon juice, lemon rind, and a crushed green olive, and that's it. It's aperitivo and soda, but just as much soda as aperitivo as lemon juice, lemon rind, olive. It's the perfect little palate cleanser. It's amazing.
It's, okay, so I'm with you. I assume... that the olive, the brininess of the olive serves a similar purpose as salt on the rim of a margarita.
Yes.
And it uses some saltiness to balance the acid and sweetness.
Sure.
And that's also some in Italy, I guess. I don't know if they ever do this, but sometimes you do an olive with, is it a Campari soda or a Negroni?
Yeah.
Or that sort of thing. Totally. So yeah, it's not unheard of.
Totally. And also just like a classic Aperol spritz, in my opinion, that's always a green olive. Always.
Yeah, I think you're insane.
But it needs it. All right. So my whole thing about this drink, right, and we talk about this with cooking at BA all the time, is that everything's about balance, right? It's like you can't have a dish that's all acid. You can't have a dish that's all sugar. You can't have a dish that's all salt, right? They have to play off each other, and they have to balance each other. You get this product that is a balanced, complete expression of whatever you're trying to cook, right? And that should always be the same ideal with cocktails. Like, with the Lil Ripper, right, you've got the sweetness of the aperitivo, you've got the bright liveliness of the soda, you have the acid of the lemon juice, and then you have the brininess of the olive. Like, it's very simple, but they're just all there. They're all playing with each other. Super, super simple, super balanced Lil Ripper.
Do you only make this for yourself, or do you ever make this for friends or special someone?
Well, but if by special someone you mean... Alex Beggs and Christina Che, who sit close to me. I've made little rippers for them. They have drained them, come back and requested that I make another.
Not surprising.
Not surprising. At home, I will make it for my roommate, Greg Costanzo.
Your special someone.
My special someone, Greg. And then, yeah, the woman that I'm currently dating, I've made one for her as well, and she has been into it.
Okay, so that recipe are we on? Is that recipe going to be published on Bonappetit.com?
It will be published on Bonappetit.
All right, so keep an eye out for the Little Ripper. The spaghetti you can find on Bonappetit, highly recommend. That came out a few weeks ago. And then what about the siesta?
Siesta, we have an official recipe for the siesta at Bonappetit.com. And then I also did a kind of an ode to the siesta article maybe last year. And that is also on Bonappetit.com.
I missed that one.
It's kind of required reading, so.
All right, I'll get on that. Alex Lenny, thanks for the drinks.
Thanks, Adam.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che, and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.